The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, March 24th, the She-E Uh-Oh edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia. And in New York, we have June Thomas, managing producer of Slate Podcasts. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah.
So I want to say before we get started that I idly chatted about Mad Max last time we had a show. And woof. Boom. How many emails and Facebook mails did I get about my complete ignorance? There were so many, I can't count them. There are lots of Mad Max fans out there. So I'm just going to read one from Keith Hooker, who wrote me on Facebook. He says, you should argue that Furiosa is the movie's hero, because while Max enters the movie as a bitter loner and exits as a slightly less bitter loner, it's Furiosa who puts aside her dream of paradise and reluctantly fights to take her place as the new enlightened ruler of the wasteland. So I thought that was the most convincing argument I heard, although believe me, people wrote me tomes, and thank you to all of you. I now have great appreciation for Mad Max.
I now am resolved to watch it, because all of that was totally Greek to me, but the emails made me think it was a movie I'd like.
Yeah, and there's more going on than you see, and I actually have greater appreciation after reading the whole, like, reading people's passion about the movie. So thank you all. Okay. So our topics today, first, we're going to talk about Neil Gorsuch, Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. Second, Thinks, the supposedly feminist forward-thinking company, has a sexual harassment claim against it. And third, do women like to compete? New research says yes, but under limited circumstances. We will discuss. So let's get going with our first topic. Neil Gorsuch, Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, has had his confirmation hearings this week. He was smooth. He really did he was impressive, I would say. And a lot of issues came up that concern us here at XX. What he feels about women in employment, his jurisprudence involving religious groups, and abortion, of course. So to help us parse through this, we have Mark Joseph Stern, legal writer for Slate. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming.
Absolutely. So have you been glued to the hearings? Is that what you've been doing this week?
Regrettably, I have been. I have been sitting at home because our fearless correspondent, Dahlia Lithwick, volunteered to actually be there in person. So I have been sitting at home with C-SPAN 3, which is what he was relegated to today, on the TV, just watching, totally hypnotized by his weird, smooth, bland performance. And I'm just so excited to talk about him now and for the next 45 years.
So let's start, before we get into the actual issues, of which there are a few I'm really interested in, his performance, it was interesting to me. It was like folksy, understated. He really charmed some people. It was self-deprecating. I mean, I didn't watch the whole thing. I'm just listening to snippets on the radio or looking at snippets on TV. Was it like that the whole time?
Yeah, but, I think I'd give him about a B-, because even though he did the folksy charm thing decently well, he did it so relentlessly that it started to feel like a mask about halfway through the day. And you could see the mask kind of slip when a Democratic senator really grilled him on an issue that he feels passionately about but did not want to actually talk about at the hearings. He would start to get a little frustrated. He would kind of growl a little. There were some tense moments, and then he would snap back into his, well, gosh, golly, darn it, I'm dropping my ends, and I'm just a fisherman from Colorado kind of shtick. So I think it worked as well as it needed to, but that is not who he really is deep down.
Mark, you had a piece on in Slate on Tuesday that said that although at this point we don't expect Supreme Court nominees to actually answer questions and reveal their views of jurisprudence, but you said that Gorsuch was worse than any of the recent nominees.
Did I
understand that right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I actually went back and watched somewhat painful YouTube clips of the last five or six nominees, and they all said more substantive things than Gorsuch has said so far. They were at least willing to say, for instance, I think that Brown versus Board of Education was the correct interpretation of the Constitution, something that Neil Gorsuch wasn't quite willing to say because he didn't want to commit himself to supporting or disfavoring any precedents because that, in his mind, would tip his hand to future litigants. You know, in previous years, Ruth Bader Ginsburg was willing to say that she thinks abortion is, you know, a constitutionally protected right. Justice Sonia Sotomayor, when she was in her hearing, said that affirmative action could comport with the Equal Protection Clause. You know, these people actually reveal things about their judicial philosophies because that's kind of what these hearings are for. You don't have to say, I'll rule against this party or I think that this theory is indisputably correct, but you should give, you know, some indication of how you serve as a judge. And Gorsuch just didn't really do that. He kept falling back on these bromides and platitudes. He would quote Socrates. He would say, I'm a fair judge. I wear honest black robes and do his folksy shtick. But he didn't say almost anything of substance. And I think that was pretty infuriating for court watchers like me who want some indication of how he'll rule when he's on the bench for the next, like, two centuries.
And do you think that's a result of where these confirmation hearings have naturally been leading, or is that him? Like, I went back and listened to a little bit of the Bork hearings, you know, where the term to get borked comes from. And Bork was actually having debate. He was speaking very frankly or relatively frankly about his judicial philosophy. They were having actual debates about what he believed and what the opposition was. And, you know, he got borked. So I feel like since then, it's been a kind of steady denuding where we land at Gorsuch, who's just like, judges just judge, you know, and that's all anyone will say from now on.
Yeah, that's right. I think denuding is the right word. Certainly, everyone is afraid of getting borked, absolutely everybody. And if they get into debates on TV, then they look condescending and nasty. I think one of the things that sunk Bork was that he just seemed like a real jerk. And Gorsuch absolutely wants to avoid that. And, you know, as we've moved forward into an increasingly politicized era, every justice, every judge is aware that their words will be used against them, that they'll turn up in ads. You know, there's a $10 million campaign behind Gorsuch's confirmation. Just as easily, a $10 million campaign could spring up in opposition. And so I think he just doesn't want to say anything that could be used in an ad that people really care that much about. So long as he stays bland, he can count on 52 votes from Republicans, and he might even be able to angle those 8 votes or a few more votes from Democrats so we can pass the 60-vote threshold and not even have to worry about filibuster drama.
So you seem to think there's something underneath this. So let's talk about the something underneath this. What's most interesting to you? There's his views on religious groups. I'm just going to say the things that have come up. Religious groups, employment discrimination, and Roe v. Wade. Those are the three that I think are relevant to us. So which of those do you think reveals the most about him or has the most to discuss?
Well, I think they're all really intertwined with him. Abortion, religious liberty, and employment are all sort of bundled up in the same ball of twine for him because his most infamous rulings, I think, are, well, it's a concurrence in the Hobby Lobby case and joining a dissent in the sequel to the Hobby Lobby case. And in these decisions, he made very, very clear that he thinks that corporations under the Federal Religious Freedom Restoration Act, corporations have the religious right to exercise their religious beliefs in a manner that may discriminate against employees. In Hobby Lobby, he said that a corporation should be allowed to deny women access to certain contraception through health insurance plans that they helped to pay for. And in these decisions, he did not seem to care in any capacity about the women who were being discriminated against. He fully accepted at face value the corporation's argument that things like IUDs were abortifacients, which they are not. And he just ruled like, this is what the law says. these guys get to do whatever they want, and I'm not even going to look at what effect it has because that's not my job. I'm just a judge, not a legislator. So I think in those decisions, it's all sort of bundled up. You see him falling head over heels for the corporations that have this sort of wacky, unscientific conception of contraception as being abortifacients, which they are not. You see his extraordinary solicitude for corporations and business owners and his desire to give them whatever they need under the law. And you see his rather blithe callousness toward employees, toward actual human workers who are going to suffer when their bosses are basically inflicting their own religious views onto them.
And we don't know much about his actual views on abortion, right? There's some tea leaf reading that people have been doing in a book that he wrote, but he hasn't actually come out and taken a position ever anywhere.
Well, yeah, but the tea leaf reading is pretty strong at this point. You know, he wrote this entire book about death with dignity laws. He called them assisted suicide, assisted euthanasia, and came out very, very strongly against them. And all of his reasoning seems to be a sort of not-so-subtle jab at abortion as well. He studied in Oxford under this guy very well known for his natural law theories that are opposed, vigorously opposed to abortion, to homosexuality, to all the kinds of things that people like us worry about and hope that the law would protect. And his general view of the law and of the 14th Amendment seems to be rather cramped and does not seem to have any kind of room for an understanding of, for instance, liberty to include an individual's right to make, you know, personal autonomous decisions about her reproductive system. That's just not the kind of judge he is, and it's not where his personal sentiments seem to lie. So yes, it's tea leaves, but I would bet a great deal of money that if abortion were on a ballot initiative, Neil Gorsuch would vote against it.
Hey, Mark, I have a question that sort of puts Gorsuch in a positive light. So this morning on the New York Times podcast, The Daily, the host spoke with Cynthia Orr, who I believe was the plaintiff in Cynthia Orr versus City of Albuquerque, which was a case about... So Cynthia Orr sued when the police department that she worked for didn't give her adequate maternity benefits. And she, on the podcast, she said, you know, this went for years. I was despairing. No one was helping me. No one seemed to be sympathetic. And then Gorsuch made a ruling that recognized that she did indeed have a right to maternity leave that was somewhat equitable to other kinds of sick leave that this department offered. Can you tell us a little bit about that case? And is this indeed something that we should praise Gorsuch for?
Yeah, I mean, I think you described his decision well. It was a very straightforward and correct decision to my mind. And I think that he does deserve praise in the sense that, you know, he is not an extremely partisan judge in the mold of Justice Alito, who will rule against the sympathetic plaintiff every time in an employment discrimination case, who will always follow the GOP party line. That's not who Gorsuch is, and this case is a good example of how he will deviate from the party line, and despite all of my negativity about him, I will say there are other decisions, some First Amendment decisions, in which he has ruled for the little guy, as Democratic senators would put it. He has shown impartiality, no doubt. He has shown commitment to some broad constitutional principles that may at times not be favored by the Republican Party itself. And this is another example of how, you know, sometimes he will absolutely follow the law and it will lead him to what I think is a good place. But you can also come up with examples where he's followed what he sees as the law to a bad place. The most notorious example is the frozen trucker case that the senator spent all day on Tuesday talking about. I think the importance of that case is a little overstated, and I think that the controversy is a little bit much, but it does show you pretty nicely how Gorsuch will never, ever, ever go out of his way to try to read the law's intent, read the law's purpose as, you know, a broad grant of rights to employees against discrimination or danger. He will follow what he sees as the letter of the law, even when it leads to a bad and, frankly, absurd place.
Mark, it's interesting that one of the cases that he seems to have been, you know, praised for by liberals involves maternity leave, when it's also one of the controversies dogging him in this confirmation hearings also involves maternity leave when he was a law professor, according to one student in another anonymous letter supporting her. He said in class something to the effect that, you know, big law firms are within their rights to ask young women who are interviewing for jobs whether they intend to have children, because women are basically trying to bilk law firms for maternity leave and then they'll leave after they have the baby and have used the maternity leave. And that rubbed at least a couple of his students the wrong way.
Yes, although I think we have to lard up that allegation with reportedlys and purportedlys and allegedlys, because we have, you know, two people who say it happened and other people who have come forward and put it in a very different light that's much more sympathetic to Gorsuch. But, you know, just assuming that that report was true, it was extraordinarily disturbing because it reflects a once ubiquitous view of women in the workplace. You know, I don't need to tell you guys that for decades and decades, a huge barrier of entry to the workplace for women was this fear, a very discriminatory fear by employers that women would simply come in, get a job, and then seize maternity leave and exploit those benefits. That view has been legislated against. We have laws protecting women from employers who might inflict that view upon them. But allegedly, Gorsuch did raise it in the classroom as a real possibility. And in fact, according to these reports, said, you know, companies have to protect their own interests against these women who are trying to exploit their generous maternity leave policies, which is just an odious thing to say. And I think it does kind of tie into his decisions regarding contraception, contraceptive care, where you see absolutely no regard for the women who might be harmed by these views. It's all about the employer. It's all about the corporation. So presuming he did say that, it's definitely disturbing. It shows that he will side with, I think, the employer. He's much more sympathetic to the employer in these types of situations. And he might even still hold on to this really ugly, pernicious myth that a lot of women only enter the workplace so that they can exploit those maternity leaves and then get out the door fast.
Although I actually emailed my sister, who is a lawyer and has kids, and she was like, yeah, a lot of people don't want to work at a big law firm once they have a kid, and they will use their maternity leave to look for another job, which doesn't seem crazy to me. It's just the notion that a priori every woman is, like, you know, looking to milk them for that 6 months off or whatever.
I felt like it must have been an interpretation. Like, it just didn't seem plausible to me that as an experienced judge, he would say exactly that in front of a law school class. It was so bordering on illegal. Like, right. If anything, you know, as an originalist, he's a person who, you know, I follow faithfully the letter of the law, and that's how I rule, regardless of consequences, you know. And given that Cynthia, sorry, I forgot her last name case, the case in which he voted for the policewoman that you, or case, thank you. It seemed like he must have said something that kind of, I wish there had been an audio recording, because I can almost see what you're saying, Noreen. Like, he said something like, of course this happened, and then there was kind of split interpretations of what he actually said.
Yeah, but, and law professors, I didn't know what to do with throw them. Out kind of wacky hypotheticals in class all the time, and they try to test the limits of analysis. And so I could definitely see this as a hypothetical gone terribly awry. That is one understandable interpretation.
I know that we're running out of time, but we should just not let this topic end before we mention that, of course, this is really Merrick Garland's seat.
Yes.
I mean, there's just that. Will we? I guess we'll just forget that soon, and we're just carrying on as if nothing happened, and there's nothing we can do about it, right?
Well, I don't know what the alternative is, except to just be constantly called sore losers by Republicans who are trying to memory hole Merrick Garland altogether, because now this is Gorsuch's seat and screw Merrick. But there are a lot of liberals and Democrats who are absolutely correct to continue on insisting on hearings for Garland. This was his seat. You know, the president of the United States nominated him, and the Senate did something it has simply never done before and refused to even consider. consider him. I think Dahlia and I considered, like, always writing Merrick Garland's name and then scratching it out and then putting Gorsuch when we write about him, something like that, to just keep him in the mix, maybe when we go to oral arguments, to add fake questions from Justice Garland. But we don't know if there's a really feasible way to make it happen, but he'll always be there in my heart, I promise.
Well, thank you, Mark, for joining us. Have fun watching the hearings today, and we will get back in touch soon.
All right, thank you. I will not have fun, but I very much appreciate that.
So before we move on to our second topic, which is the harassment claim against Thinks, let's talk about our Slate Plus. June, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, this week we'll be talking about BBC Man and whether the response to his famous pushing away of his children when they barged into the room was sexist. But I also want to mention that for those folks who have been curious about these extra Slate Plus segments, which, listeners, let me assure you, are jewels of audio entertainment and delight, I want to mention that you can now get to hear them free for 90 days. Just download our new iOS app at slate.com/app, that's APP, and you can get all the benefits of Slate Plus for 3 months. That's slate.com/APP.
All right, our second topic for today, Thinks. Have you guys ever seen those underwear ads that look like the anti-lingerie ads? Underwear for women with periods, or anti-patriarchy underwear. I'm actually not sure. Do you guys know if they're only in the New York City subway? They must be elsewhere, right?
You know, I should know that, and I don't. They're definitely, if you live in New York, you've seen them. Yeah. I think they serve their ads pretty heavily on social media, Facebook and Instagram.
All right, so I'm sure people in major cities have seen them outside in the world. Other people have seen them on social media. They're women doing you go girl things, looking serious and wearing underwear. It's a company called Thinks. It's run by a woman named Miki Agrawal, who describes herself as someone who doesn't play by the rules. Well, as our own Noreen Malone chronicled, she doesn't play by the rules in other ways, too. Now she's being sued by a 26-year-old employee alleging basically a hostile work environment. Noreen, I got to say, I found this such an interesting lawsuit because the story of a hostile work environment is so the story of patriarchy that it's very hard to put a woman as the lead alleged villain in that story. So can you just talk a little bit about what happened and what this 26-year-old is alleging happened?
Sure, absolutely. So the important context with Thinks is that from the very beginning, Miki Agrawal, who was until very recently, about a week ago, the CEO and had the idea for period underwear, the branding of the company was super duper feminist. That was just, they wanted to remove the taboo around periods. Taboo was something that Agrawal said a lot. So then she stepped down as CEO. She initially said that she was remaining on as CEO, which is a title that she likes to use in her correspondence. So in talking to current and former employees, and as detailed in this claim brought by Chelsea Liebau, who used to be the head of PR for the company, she really took that taboo breaking too far. She allegedly did things like she would grab her employees' breasts and sort of marvel at their size and shape. Liebau says that she got a nipple piercing and her boss asked her to come into her office and show her, and she did because she felt too uncomfortable. Employees also allege that Agrawal would just, you know, change all the time, either out in the open or in her office, which is glass pane so everyone could see it. She spoke about Liebau's nipple piercing at from the stage at a conference without having cleared it with Liebau first. And then they say that she talked a ton about her sex life and things she wanted to try in her sex life. Sort of most notably, she went around, you know, they were at a meeting and she went around and asked people if they had tried polyamory. Other people say she would, you know, hit on her assistant. She called her assistant hot a lot. She would supposedly introduce her assistant, who happened to be a lesbian, by saying that they flirted all the time. And this was all against the backdrop of a company where employees felt intimidated. She was an extraordinarily difficult boss by all accounts. She would threaten to fire people all the time. There was an open forum last March in which people brought up the fact that, they'd taken away vacation days. They'd taken away a week of vacation days. So they had an open forum where people could talk about, you know, the benefits and how they were feeling at the company. And when people were vocal in that meeting, one woman said that, you know, the healthcare plan was so bad that she couldn't afford birth control. And this was supposed to be a feminist company. There was no maternity leave policy. People say that she froze people out who were vocal in that meeting and spoke up. One person even who'd spoken up a lot was fired a few weeks later. And so there's just a lot going on there. And the other piece of this puzzle is that there was no HR. So there was no one for these women. It's a mostly female company, not entirely. There's no one for these women to talk to about these problems, which a lot of startups don't have HR. And, you know, that can be a problem.
And that was one of when Agrawal responded, which she did very notably in a Medium post. She essentially, you know, played the startup card, mm-hmm. which, you know, I think is a relatively, you know, convincing argument to a lot of people that, like, we're just going all out trying to make this company work. We're just like, we're figuring this out. We're not perfect. Mm-hmm. But clearly, according to this, not only to this lawsuit, but to many reports in a story that you published in January and in other stories that have appeared in Jezebel and in Racked, that there were a lot of complaints about the way she behaved at the company. And it wasn't really just about being a startup, right?
No. I mean, Thinx is particularly interesting because, again, it's this almost all female culture where they are talking about their major product is something that has to do with a bodily function that they are trying to get people to actually talk about and not mm-hmm. feel ashamed about talking about. And the way people described, you know, people on the content and branding teams described it to me is like, it's like being in a writer's room, mm-hmm. you know, for a TV where you just will share an embarrassing story or something that made you feel ashamed or vulnerable.
And that was so that then they could craft a campaign that would help people not
yes.
feel the shame around
yes.
periods and bleeding and all of that.
Right. So they did. Yes. Yeah. So they would also do things like have ads that had, you know, visible stretch marks, because that had obviously come up in some meeting that women were ashamed of their stretch marks and they should, you know, try to remove that shame.
But then the complaint said that the Agrawal would fat shame people, right?
Yeah, that's true. They had one of their few perks that they all seemed to really love was Ice Cream Fridays. And she suggested taking away Ice Cream Fridays because it's unhealthy. And she wanted Fruit Fridays instead. And people were not happy about that. But the other thing about this company is that everyone was pretty young. A lot of people were friends beforehand. You know, they brought in their friends to work there, or they became fast friends there when you're all in your 20s. So people did, they did talk about their sex lives with one another, you know. So the lines are super blurred there, but she was the boss. And mm-hmm. universally, people said, I just didn't feel comfortable talking with her in the same way. There was this power imbalance. And another interesting thing there, people, you know, even the woman who brought the sexual harassment claim against her said, I didn't think she was trying to sleep with me.
Yeah.
It was more a power thing. It felt like she was objectifying me in a weird way. And this woman said, you know, it was me and other women whose bodies were on the curvier end of the spectrum. She would sort of, again, objectify us, draw a lot of attention to our bodies. And she's this woman was made very uncomfortable by it.
This I'm really embarrassed about. I do not understand what period underwear is. I genuinely don't understand what the hell that could possibly mean. Like, isn't every honestly, like, I just don't get how what it is. Do you know what it is?
Well, it's funny because that is how I got interested in the whole Mickey Agrawal phenomenon to start with. I'd seen these ads for period underwear and I was like, that's stupid. That's period underwear is just either the ancient stuff at the back of your drawer or like some black underwear. Right. Like, that's what period underwear is. But Thinx is made out of a special fabric. I forget what the special fabric is. But the idea is that it's sort of moisture wicking in these certain ways. So it will absorb, you know, spillover on heavy days. And if you want to free bleed on lighter days, you can also do that. And you have to hand wash them. So that is what period underwear is if you don't want to worry about, you know, leaking.
And if you don't want to wear a tampon or a pad.
Right.
On
right,
a light.
Right, right, right. So that's
what free bleeding is.
Right. Which I realize is sort of maybe a recent term of art that people have gotten really into. But there's a whole free bleeding, you know, period feminism movement that we have too much shame around that time of the month.
okay, I think we've crossed a line here. we're going to cross back again. no, it's fine. I don't really, I mean, I totally get it, but like, ew, with the free bleeding, like, it's just not comfortable. This isn't like a, I don't have shame. I just like, you know.
Yeah.
Yuck. It's like peeing in your pants, and I don't want to do that. All right. Our third topic, women in competition. A new study out in May complicates the long-held view that men are more competitive than women. In this case, researchers tested a third theory that women are competitive under certain conditions. In this case, they're competitive when they are competing against themselves and their own time. And in fact, women did decide to enter competitions and be more competitive under this condition. So, guys, have you followed this? You know, this is like a long-held thing. There's always a study saying women are less competitive than men, right? Like, it's just been proven over and over again. So say researchers.
Yeah, it was interesting when as we were doing the reading, seeing all these studies, like, oh, yeah, I've heard about it. Oh, yeah, that one too. And they're all so similar, and they all seem to come up with more or less the same slightly depressing findings, which then they kind of, well, let me ask one more question. Hey, what about if we, and finally a study has found out, well, what about if we, that is somewhat positive for women?
Mm-hmm. Now, I've got to object to this whole field of study.
Yeah.
And anybody who's listening can totally take me up on this. But here's my genuine problem with this field of study. It is perfectly possible that women are not interested in pointless lab study competition. Like, what these studies show is that in certain lab conditions, when there is no stakes to the competition, women don't choose to enter the more competitive state. So it's usually a thing where, like, you can earn more money if you choose to compete against people. It's like an all or nothing situation if you choose the competitive mode. And you know, they'll show that even women who are competent at X task, whether X task is like completing mazes or doing math problems, even when women are shown to be as competent in phase one, they don't choose to enter the competition in phase two, they'd rather just like low level it.
Well, also, I think it's weird that it's always math problems, right? Because research consistently shows that somewhere in middle school or high school, women frankly get socialized out of being confident in math. So if you want to measure women's actual competitiveness, maybe choose a less fraught test case, right, than asking women to do math problems going up against other people. I think I would be, you know, less likely to choose the super competitive option in math problems, frankly, than I would in some other, you know, test of wit or whatever.
So it does seem like these math problems were actually arithmetic problems. There was nothing terribly complicated about them.
I haven't done math in a really long time. You overestimate me.
Don't get me wrong. Me neither. The other thing, while we're adding our, this is why I wouldn't be bothered with this. Like, there's a sort of a rational element to this. So as we've been saying, often the way that these things are tested is you get $1 per math problem correctly solved, or you can opt instead to compete with somebody and you'll get the winner will get $2 and the loser will get no dollars. Well, it seems to me that there's a rational option that says I would rather, even if I feel that I'm a good math problem solver, I would rather have the sure money of $1 per correctly solved problem because I'm good at solving problems and I'll get it. I'm guaranteed $1 for all the ones I get, rather than taking a gamble on being up against someone who might be a genius or might just, you know, might be cheating or whatever. I would take that sure money. That's like the whole thing with, like, poor people don't have the option of investing. They take their $1 and keep their $1 because they need that $1 to buy something instead of investing 50 cents and getting $5 down the road. They need the dollar. That seems like a rational point of view to me.
Although it does become meaningful later in life. Like, that's the
Absolutely.
Same argument that women can do well in school. Like, women do well as long as the rules are prescribed and there's a sure reward for doing well. But once you get out into the big bad world where it's a little more risky and it's all or nothing, then you just kind of keep to your safe space.
Yeah.
So that interpretation does make it seem like there are consequences to these decisions.
There's definitely consequences, but I'm still not sure that it's the wise move unless you have all kinds of backing and, you know, support to take the gamble.
Yeah.
And one of the examples that they give from another study was they've tested these competition theories around the world. And in patriarchal culture or patrilineal cultures, the findings seem to be the same as in the US. But there was one culture in northeastern India that was a matrilineal culture, and there the women chose to compete. And the interpretation of this was that, well, they have a long history of keeping their money and passing their goods and their savings and everything that they have onto their children, onto their daughters. So therefore, they are more minded to risk. And that was interesting, but I also still want to hold on to my dollar.
Well, and also being risk averse is something that lately it's become fashionable to praise women for that in corporate environments. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, we need more women on the board or in the, you know, at this investment bank because men are too willing to like gamble it all away. Yeah. And the women will be a chastening force there, which, I, you know, there are a whole set of other issues with that kind of argument. But some people are spinning this, you know, maybe more moderate view of competition as a good thing.
Yeah.
I like to think that women take meaningful risks. That's mm-hmm. why I think these lab experiments don't show much. Mm-hmm. You know, when they always measure what's important to women, what's important to men in their workplace and in promotions, they almost always find the same thing, which is that women are much more interested in meaning at work, whereas men are more interested in pretty concrete status symbols like money and title. And that doesn't necessarily lead you to a better place in the workplace. It's just different things that you value. So it seems to me that when it matters to women, they're competitive. When it's something like, I'm going to get the money so I can save the money to give it to my children, whatever it is, the meaning that you're finding. I mean, you all know women who are perfectly competitive, right? It just seems like there has to be something else besides the purity of the competition. Like, I'm willing to believe that just pure competition for competition's sake doesn't necessarily drive a majority of women. But that doesn't mean they're not competitive.
Right.
Totally. It just seemed like, okay, the scenario in which you're going head against another person is so rare now that, I mean, so first of all, isn't all competition really against yourself, right? Like when it comes down to it. And I think women are good at that, as the study showed. But also, most of the time, at least for me in the workplace, it feels like team competition, like you're part of a team trying to do something rather than you trying to like shiv your coworker. That seems super unhealthy. Like, right? So it's like you're working with other people to, you know, beat, in my case, it's like we want to get better stories in the other magazines or whatever. But, you know, I don't know what an more universal example would be. But it just seems to me like this formulation where they were measuring competitiveness was so strange. And at least for me, it's very easy to summon a competitive spirit when it's like in service of, you know, some larger group that I'm part of.
Right. I've seen you at Trivia Night.
Yeah, I love Trivia Night.
But that's also a classic thing about women is that they compete and are allowed to compete and do not violate social expectations if they are very competitive in the service of a team. So it can be yourself and a team. It could be yourself and your children. It could be yourself and your company. But that people don't get freaked out when women are competitive for some greater good, however that greater good is. They do get freaked out, and it does trigger a kind of, you know, you're a bitch problem if you are competitive purely for yourself, like give me more money or give me a promotion, that triggers a kind of stigma. Mm. And that sucks.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some women do just want to be competitive. Here, does this ever engender in you guys the kind of feminist utopia thought? Like, why do we need to be competitive? It does that in me. I'm like, why did we all decide that being competitive was even a positive thing? Like, why do workplaces need to? I work in a very collaborative, very female workplace right now. It doesn't seem to me any less hard-driven, any less hard-working, any less committed to kind of quality or, you know, kind of being really great. It just doesn't happen to be especially competitive. Yeah.
But you guys are not competitive with each other. You're competitive, I'm sure, with yourselves and with the greater podcast universe. You know, you want to get that story. You want to make it really good. I mean, I think competition's important. I love being competitive. But this, like, this sort of like pro wrestling conception of it seems alien to me. And I don't think I see a lot of men doing that version of it either. Don't know.
Yeah, I agree. It feels like I'm always really like, I hate to even use this word because it seems so sappy, but I'm always really inspired by people who you know, don't settle. They're pushing and pushing and pushing because they want the thing that they're working on to be the best it can possibly be. And that's awesome. But that whole, like, let's play foosball and, like, I'm going to kill you, that just seems boring to me. I just want to turn around and walk away. I have no interest in that kind of competition. That's about, like, beating someone. That just makes me want to walk away. But getting something to be awesome, that's fantastic.
I will slip in the women in sports thing here, like the idea that there's some sort of fixed bar of competitiveness in women has to have changed with the entry of women into really competitive sports and little girls, and they're aggressive and vicious and they want to win. So maybe you could say, okay, that's in service of a team. It's true. Like you are winning it for your team, but still the women have to be more competitive. The bar has to have moved in the last, 25 years since women started playing a lot of sports.
Totally.
Okay, last thing. I was reading about this topic and my little son was trying to come up with a science experiment and he was like working in the realm of sports and competition. So he's going to do a version of this competitiveness thing where he has people race against, just race around something and then race against someone and see if that improves their time, if they run faster. And so I will report to you guys if there's he's not testing the gender thing, but just if there turns out to be some big difference between the men and the women. You know, if the men just run like twice as fast when they're competing against someone than the women
everyone will run faster when they're competing against someone. That's just human nature. I don't know. I think women are a lot more competitive than these studies are showing again, I'm not a scientist, as I've announced every other week on this podcast, but I just, my gut is that women can be super, super competitive and often are.
Okay, well, let's move on to our recommendations. Noreen, what do you have for us today?
I'm going to recommend a book I wasn't sure I would like, and I ended up loving. I inhaled Kat Marnell's How to Murder Your Life. So Kat Marnell was an internet phenomenon a few years ago. She's a beautiful woman who was a beauty editor who also wrote openly about smoking PCP, among many other drugs that she talked about doing. And she worked for XO Jane and Vice, and then she sort of disappeared to write this memoir, which just came out. And, addiction memoirs can be super compelling, but they can also be super depressing. And this was both of those things. But she is just a really funny, lively writer. And if you're at all inclined to read about that sort of thing, she's great company. And, it doesn't have a neat, if you've read any of the articles about her, she is still struggling with addiction. It doesn't have that neat narrative at the end. So it's upsetting in that way. But also you marvel at her just like sort of spirit, I would say. So How to Murder Your Life by Kat Marnell.
Okay, so my recommendation, I just got to be honest about the thing that gave me the most pleasure this week, and it comes from your magazine, Noreen. At least that's where I read about it. It was I don't know who Goth Miss Frizzle is, but it was Goth Miss Frizzle's running commentary on Roger Stone's outfit in the inauguration, and I swear to God, it is the funniest freaking Twitter thread ever. Like, it's just so funny. It's just a continuous description of his outfit. and it's like, it's just so funny. It's like, it just goes on and on. My guy looks like he drives a cartoon donkey cart with a cage full of missing children on the back. My boy looks like Willy Wonka if it took place during the Industrial Revolution and all the kids just straight up died. My dude looks like a tax collector from a candy-themed board game. It is like I've never heard so many funny descriptions of the same outfit ever. So Goth Miss Frizzle, you are a genius, whoever you are. And yeah, just entertain yourself and read it. It's so funny. Okay, June.
So I'm going to recommend kind of a couple of TV shows, and I'm going to take you on a journey with me. So this came into my mind because I was listening to the Magnificent Slate podcast Represent, which is usually hosted by the great Aisha Harris. But last episode, there was a long interview that our producer, Verilyn Williams, conducted with Journey Smollett-Bell and Amira Van from Underground, which is a fantastic show on WGN. It's about enslaved persons, enslaved people, and the Underground Railroad. It's a historical drama. It's very good. I recommend it. And season 2 just started. And season two sees the arrival in the show of Harriet Tubman, and she's played by Aisha Hines, who's a magnificent actress, and she is in another show that I would like to recommend, which begins on the day that we're taping this, March 22nd. It's called Shots Fired. It's on Fox, and it's about what happens when a black cop kills a white kid in a small town in North Carolina. And so people go to investigate. There's a great investigator played by Sanaa Lathan. And there are some other fine actors, including Helen Hunt and Richard Dreyfuss. But Aisha Hines plays in Shots Fired a sort of radical minister who is kind of a Black Lives Matter leader and also a spiritual leader. And it's a really good show. Like, I'm making it sound like it's super issues oriented, which it is, but it's just a really good drama. And it's, of course, it becomes much more complicated than it appears in the first episode. And I thought that Underground, Shots Fired, and represents Verilyn's interview with the women from Underground. They're all awesome. Enjoy them all. That's all.
June, one more announcement before we go.
Yes, indeed. Something for listeners who are also journalists. Slate is hiring a politics editor. Do you want to direct some of the best political reporters and writers in the business during one of the most tumultuous moments in American history? Then you should apply. If you're interested and have at least 5 years of experience covering U.S. politics, send a cover letter and resume to politicseditor@slate.com. And to learn more about the job and the requirements, go to slate.com/politics editor.
Awesome. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks to our producer, Verilyn Williams, executive producer of Slate Podcast, Steve Lichtai, and Andy Bowers, the chief content officer of the Panoply Network, and our intern, Daniel Schrader. The Double X Gap Fest is part of the Panoply Network. You can check out the entire roster at itunes.com/panoply. Our show page to find out more about the show and read our recommendations, slate.com/XX. Facebook, facebook.com/XXGabFest, where many of you have been coming on to share your comments and tell us what to talk about. Email, also thank you for all your emails, XXGabFest@slate.com. You can subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave comments so other people can find out about the show. That's all for today. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will be back in 2 weeks.